September, October, November. Have a time you'll always remember. At beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Make your fall fabulous at Mount Airy Lodge or Pocono Gardens. Do all the things you've wanted to do all summer, all day, all night. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 966-7210 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Hello and welcome to FW Presents, the anthology show for the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is another episode of Mountain Comics, the show where I look back at the comic books I bought while on vacation in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania in the 1970s and 1980s. And joining me in the cabin this week for the season finale of Mountain Comics is Fire and Water Network pal, Matt Sirois. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
It's great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Now, you've been commenting on various shows across the network for a long time now, and I'm always happy to read your commentary. It's always very thoughtful and insightful and fun. But you told me this, you've never done a podcast before, so this is your first time?
Yes, this is my debut.
Okay. Well, a lot of people that I have done podcasts with, which is their first time, have gone on to podcasting careers. So maybe this will be the start of something really amazing, Matt.
You'll infect me with the bug.
Right, possibly. That is my goal. We need more podcasters out there. So anyway, we're here to talk about Kazar the Savage number 8, which was on sale July 28th, 1981. Weird way to kind of end the season, but I have my reasons for it. We'll get into it shortly. But before we talk about the comic, Matt, I want to ask you, like, what's your experience with vacation comics? Did you have something like this where you bought comics specifically while you were on vacation?
We did. We did go to Newfound Lake up in New Hampshire. We live in Massachusetts every year. And normally, especially for the drive up there, you know, my parents would like us to have comics or just something to keep us quiet.
Sure.
But for me, I cannot remember a time before comics in my life, because my dad was the second oldest of 8 kids in his family.
Whoa!
So we had uncles who were teenagers growing up, and my Uncle Frank, who was also my godfather, was a huge comic fan, but not a collector. Mm-hmm. And he would read his comics, and when we would visit my grandparents, where he was still living, especially in the summers, there was always a big cookout at the beginning of the summer and a cookout at the end of the summer, and he would give us a stack of comics.
Nice.
I mean, a stack. And often there would be just about any Marvel or DC characters, and usually a couple of issues of Mad Magazine, which my mother would confiscate, not because we weren't allowed to have them, but because she had first dibs. She was going to read the magazine first.
That's great.
And then
we
could read them. So I have always loved comics. Most of my youth was just Spider-Man, Batman, Justice League. But I had access to almost everything. And of all the comics, like I said, he would always give us a big stack, because once he was, you know, done reading them, there was one comic he kept that he has passed away, so it's now in my possession. But the one single comic book he kept was Justice League number 200.
Oh, now you're speaking my language.
And that was his favorite book. It was his prized possession, and it's in a spot of honor where I have some comics that are sentimental value to me. It's still, you know, this is not my Justice League of America 200. This is my late Uncle Frank's Justice League of America 200.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's great. Do you have it like on a turntable with like a key light on it or anything like that?
Something to spin and remember.
Yeah.
No, but I have a binder with, you know, the first comic I bought with my own money. The first 3 comics that I decided, like, all right, I'm collecting comics now. I started reading about 78, 79, but it wasn't until about 83 that I became what you would consider a collector.
Now, you mentioned, you said us, so you have siblings, right?
I have an older sister and a younger brother. And my brother liked some of the comics, my sister liked some of the comics, but I was, of the three of us, I was the fanatic.
Hit you the hardest. Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool. That's fantastic. I would have loved to have a family member have done something like that. I know that our beloved late pal, Zoom, you can already talk about his Uncle Kenzo, that would give him all these kinds of amazing comics. So that's really cool to have a family that was so immersed. I can't imagine my mom doing something like grabbing Mad Magazine and reading.
She's like, I got the Mad Magazine. magazine first before you wreck it doing the fold-ins.
That is awesome.
It was great because sometimes, you know, when we were younger, some of those Mad Magazine jokes could go right over our heads.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And since she had read it, she could explain the joke to us. Oh, you know, that's... Mom, who's the Spiro Agnew guy they're always after?
That is fantastic. I love hearing that. That's so wonderful. So very, very cool. All right. So we're here to tell you that we're here to talk about Kazar number 8. The cover is, and you'll see some of the images, of course, on our website, finewaterpodcast.com. You got the cover here by Brent Anderson, and it's the shot of Kazar twirling a bolo as he's being blasted by some sort of robot. And then we down on the ground, we see Shanna the She-Devil from the back. As she's got a knife out, and there's no cover copy on this at all. In fact, they don't even have the subtitle, The Savage, even though that was the full name of the book. The only copy we get is that bloody awful Win a Columbia 10-speed Formula 10 racer banner, which ran on the top of like every Marvel comic for like 3 months in the 1980s. Again, I don't know anyone that won that actual thing. But so what do you think of the cover, Matt?
It's a fantastic cover. You got almost that Kirby crackle in the laser blast mm-hmm. from the robot. You know, it sets you up for the issue. It's one of those perfect, like, this is what you're going to get this issue of Kazar.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Brent Anderson. I mean, during this episode, I'll be talking about how much I like the artwork. I've always been a fan of his. He did that book for Marvel, Strike Force Moratori, which only lasted, I think, like 12 issues. But he did Somerset Holmes, which is a miniseries for Pacific Comics that I've talked about in another episode. So I'm a fan of his. So I always like – this might have been my first experience seeing his work. But it's a solid image. It's funny that there is no cover copy. Marvel was big on cover copy. But here, that's just real simple. Just like, okay, just a robot attacking. That's all you need to know. Here's your 50 cents, kid. And it worked on me because to this point, I don't think I had maybe even heard of Kazar. At this point, maybe I was familiar with him just in the general sense in the Marvel Universe. Maybe I'd seen him in like a Marvel team up maybe. But I was not familiar with this character at all. So this, in a lot of ways, this comic is sort of and I'll get into the details of it more later on, but this is sort of in some ways a quintessential Mountain comic because it was something that I never saw at home. This Kazar never made it to racks when I was at home. It just never, you know, the regular newsstand vendors just probably never ordered it. But it was up, you know, it was up in the Poconos, and I needed as many comics as I could get. So this is a comic I gave a shot to because I needed so much reading material. So it's one of my favorite Mountain comics. Again, we'll get into some of the other details why. So anyway, the name of the story is In the Beginning. It's by Bruce Jones, the aforementioned Brent Anderson, and the inker is Carlos Garzon. Kazar and Shanna the She-Devil are suddenly awakened from their sleep inside a cave by a loud growl. They grab their knives to defend themselves, but are relieved to see that it's their beloved companion, Zabu, who quickly nibbles on some meat roasting over a fire. Later, Kazar and Shanna head out, followed by a limping Zabu. Kazar orders Zabu, for his own health, to go wait in the cave for them. Zabu bows his head and dutifully agrees. Kazar and Shanna make their way to a chamber hidden beneath the snow. It was built by an Atlantean technology, including a man named Dirk, Shanna's former lover, who died saving both Shanna and Kazar. They are shocked to see that Dirk's body, when they last saw him, he was cryogenically frozen, is now gone. A trail of blood leads behind a wall of circuitry where they find Dirk attached to various wires and plugs. Before they have the time to figure out what happened, a robot sentry fires at them with lasers. They escape into another room, a records room. A series of tapes lays out the entire history of Earth, including how Atlantis was destroyed. It also shows that Dirk, with the help of the robot, built the cryo chamber and that the robot was clearly just a sentry built to protect its creator. Kazar realizes they have to escape the room another way, possibly through a duct. Unfortunately, the pipe he wraps on to see if it is hollow cracks open, filling the room with water. Kazar and Shanna swim to the bottom and use all their muscle to buckle the walls of the room, allowing the water to drain out. In another room, they find a half-finished Shanna robot and then are attacked again by the sentry. The robot is destroyed by a now-conscious Dirk. They watch another tape and all learn that the sentry built Dirk. In fact, the man in front of them is not human at all, but a bio-animatronic copy. Dirk determines that the sentry, who he calls Mother, built him so he could survive the harsh climates of Pangaea, which were artificially altered to become sort of huge jungle Disneyland, a resort of a kind, even going so far as to build a robot Shanna as company. Dirk wanders off, and Shanna asks where he is going. He says he's going to work on some of the controls so Pangaea remains livable for his dear Shanna. To be continued. All right, so Matt, what did you think of this issue?
This is actually a fantastic issue in this run. because not only does it give you action, mystery, and adventure, it also gives you exposition on Pangaea and the Savage Land by extension. You know, great cover, great story. It's one of the things, like, I'm not so much a Khazar fan as the Savage Land or that whole Lost Earth, Lost World mm-hmm. concept.
Mm-hmm.
Big fan of the show Land of the Lost.
Right, yeah, sure.
And I bet you when I first saw this comic, I probably equated it in my mind with that Your Hunter from the Future movie starring Reb Brown.
Right, right.
Loincloth barbarian in this future past world.
Yeah, I agree. That is, I mentioned at the top, this is sort of a quintessential Mountain comic because, like I said, I had never seen really Khazar at home. And it's the kind of thing where I had never bought an issue of Khazar before this, and I never bought one after, even though I really love this comic. When we were deciding which issue you were going to talk with me over on this episode of Mountain Comics, I was so happy that you picked Khazar, because this Khazar issue has been on the Mountain Comics to-do list for four seasons, and nobody picked it. Nobody ever picked it, because I think most people don't really care about Khazar. So I was so happy that you went for it, because I've been wanting to talk about this one forever. And it's, I never bought another issue of Khazar, not because I didn't like it. Like I said, I loved it. It's just that I never saw it again. Like, you know, I went back home to New Jersey and I never saw Khazar again. And it wasn't until I started shopping at comic stores that Khazar started appearing on my radar. And for some reason at that point, I had kind of just, you know, fallen out of it. But it was the kind of thing where I was like, wow, this one issue of Khazar is great. But it happened only that one time that because I happened to see it on sale in a newsstand in the Pocono.
Well, with issue 10, it became a direct market only comic.
Was it that soon? Was it number 10 that started with that?
Yep, issue 10, it becomes 75 cents. It's direct market only. There's a gorgeous Brett Anderson pinup at the back. Yes, yeah, so, and with issue 8, it wouldn't have even been on sale for your previous Poconos vacation.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. I knew that the book, for people who don't remember, Marvel tried this experiment, not dissimilar from what DC did with the Teen Titans and the Legion of Superheroes and the Outsiders, where they started doing direct market only books, and they picked, it was Khazar, Moon Knight, and I think Power Man and Iron Fist. I think those were the three titles that went direct market only. And I think I remember there, or maybe not Power Man and Iron Fist, but I remember there was an ad that they were talking about that these titles are going to go direct only. And I didn't know that Khazar started that soon. So yeah, no wonder I never saw Khazar again at home because it disappeared. And again, it's so strange that I didn't keep buying the book, because I really love this issue. And as you said, it works as a one and done in that, you know, Khazar and Shanna go to this this fortress buried under the snow, and they have an adventure, and they find out more about Dirk and stuff like that. D-H-E-R-K, by the way. And then it continues on. Like, the story continues, but you get a complete story here, and then it's an adventure with a beginning, middle, and end, and that's very satisfying.
It's one of my favorite things about especially comics of this era, where you had so many one and done issues, and it also does set up for the next chapter as Khazar and Shanna then venture with Derek further, or Dirk. I don't know why Derek was how I pronounced it, but they venture with him further into Pangaea and do more exploring.
Right. I know another thing that I never knew about Marvel, these characters, was I always assumed by reading this comic that Khazar and Shanna the She-Devil were like a team, you know, that they were like Hawkman and Hawkwoman, you know, or Batman and Robin. Like, they were characters always joined at the hip. But that was not the case. This actually was the book that put them together. Shanna was its own concept. She had her own title in the early 70s, and so did Khazar. And then I guess somebody decided, well, hey, you know, they're both kind of Tarzan-y characters. Let's smash them together, which, you know, I would imagine probably helps sales a little bit. And to be honest, I'm sure gave Khazar a little more sex appeal because, you know, comics at this point are still mostly boys. And here you've got a really sexy woman in a fur bikini getting to run around. And, you know, that probably helped him quite a bit. I mean, I got to say, Brent Anderson draws really beautiful women. And even though you don't even see Shanna's face on the cover, she's got this bikini bottom. And, it's, you know, it's very, you know, when you're a 10-year-old kid, you're like, well, this is cool. Look at this. This is, you know, she's pretty attractive. And the other thing is that I didn't know that even though they call him Khazar the Savage, he's not a Tarzan. You know, he's not a, B. Kazar kind of guy. Like, he speaks in full sentences. He's not a Hulk kind of guy. And so, again, the Savage thing, I was coming so much of this as kind of blind. Like, I didn't know any of these concepts at all. And Bruce Jones, again, did such a great job of explaining everything. I was 1981. I would have been 10 years, not yet 10 years old. I fully grokked everything that was going on in this issue, the setup, everything about it. And that's remarkable to be able to do. That's a great trick to be able to pull that off in just one 22 or 23 page story.
Yes. They used to really just pack these comics with information. Oddly enough, my first experience with Kazar was in Marvel 2-in-1 annual number 6, I believe, with it actually introduces American Eagle, but they end up in the Savage Land.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That apparently was on sale. I checked Mike's Amazing World. That apparently was on sale the same month as this issue.
Yep, that's a Mountain comic for me. That's on my list to cover at some point.
This, what's weird, though, is they were out at the same time. I probably read that 2-in-1 at around the time it came out, but I didn't find this group of comics until probably about 10 years later.
Where did you find that? Gets at a comic store in like a back issue bin or something?
He actually, yes, the comic, he had the first 14 issues I think I have here. They were all sealed up in a package together, and he sold it nice, like a $10 set. Right, I don't even think I cost – it probably cost me $5 at that time.
Okay. That's a good deal. That's a great – I would have said, I don't know why I have not gone out and found more of these. I could get them. I might just do it right now as soon as we're done recording this. I might go to eBay and just buy Kazar's 9, 10, and 11 just to see the continued story. So I mentioned in the plot, it opens up in them in the cave, and Zabu shows up. He's been missing for a couple of days. He shows up, and he's wounded. And he's hungry, and he immediately goes after the hunk of meat sitting on a spit that they've got going on. And then Kazar and Channa head out, and Zabu wants to follow, but he's injured, and Kazar is looking out for him. And basically, you know, he treats him like a dog. Like, he's like, you know, go in the cave and sit this one out. And poor Zabu's like, okay, so he heads off. So then they go to this secret base, and much like I have talked about in other episodes, like, I'm such a sucker for – there's a couple things in comics that I am just immediately down for. One is like things in with movies, like things about cults. I love movies with horror movies about cults. That always works for me. Comics, I love covers where like the superheroes are doing something like community wise, like they're building a statue or some sort of, they're throwing a party. I love all that stuff. But I love comics that feature secret bases. It's very James Bondian. So I love this idea that you've got the Savage Land, which is supposedly this, you know, wasteland. But then you've got this incredibly technologically advanced base, you know, hidden underneath the snow. I love all that stuff. That's just super cool. And this robot that attacks them is great. This sort of this floating sentry is really cool. And again, it's just such a great adventure of, you know, we're smashing together these very earthy characters, Kazar and Channa, and then they're in the middle of this technological thing, which again, it doesn't really. You know, it's a nice comparison because they're dressed like Tarzan and Jane, and yet in the middle of all this, you know, computer decks and these tapes and things like that. So I love that. I love that dichotomy of the two of them. And yeah, Bruce Jones does a great job with the flashbacks where we learn all about Dirk and the robot and Atlantis and all this stuff. It's really, really well done. I love all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, do you like that kind of thing? Are you big on like secret headquarters and stuff like that?
Especially when it's like when they find that you find the secret underground base and it's abandoned and it's this mystery of like, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
Who was here?
Right. Yeah,
what were they doing? And like you said, since they are, you know, Channa and Kazar are both intelligent, you know, characters, they understand these computers. They don't walk in there with like, you know, Tarzan would be and poke it with the spear and like, what this?
right, exactly.
You know, Channa right immediately is able to, you know, start putting in the tapes and understanding what's going on. It's just great, and it's so beautifully drawn too.
I mean, Brent Anderson and Carlos Garzon are a great combination. Again, I'm such a fan of Brent Anderson. He's got a kind of Neil Adamsy sort of thing, and I don't mean that in a like he's ripping it off, but his style to me is just sort of similar. There's a similar dynamism there. Carlos Garzon has an inker with a nice light touch. The idea of doing a flashback via videotapes where we just have our characters watching it kind of Mystery Science Theater style is fun, where we see all these, you know, these flashbacks and they're like, hey, look, it's Dirk, you know, their silhouettes are like right in the bottom of the screen, which is cool. And then right after that, we get into this adventure sequence where he wraps the pipe and it bursts and all the water starts filling, and they decide, okay, we're going to have to try and get out of here, and we're going to use the pressure of the water building up to break out. And Brent Anderson does a great job of, you know, of course, in comics, it's hard to convey great heights because most comic book pages are read left to right, top to bottom. But on page, I think it's, I don't know, page 12, I think, or of the story, where it's
page 13 of the comic.
There you go.
I wrote it down because it's brilliant.
Yeah, I love the water. Right, we got four panels, and this page will be on the website. We've got four panels of equal width, but they go from top to bottom of the page, and we see our characters as the water is quickly rising up, and it gets to the point where the water is now at the ceiling. And again, it's a great way of conveying you are running out of space there. And then the next page, we have three panels of Kazar and Shanna as they are kicking, they're bracing themselves against the wall, and they're trying to kick the other wall so it collapses. And the colorist, let me look up who the colorist is on this one. This is Don Warfield, I think, is that the name? I'm not familiar with that name at all, or Harfield. He does a great job where he does this monochromatic thing where they're under the water, and Shanna is talking about that her lungs are about to burst because they are running out of air. Again, it's as a kid, that really worked on me because I've never been a great swimmer. I've always been kind of a little fearful of water despite my love of Aquaman, or maybe because of it. So I love this sequence. Again, it's very James Bondian of like putting our heroes into this death trap, and they survive, of course, by the skin of their teeth. It's just a great, great moment.
Yeah, and on the next page, when they do bust out that middle panel of the big sploosh.
Sploosh, yeah.
You almost feel that water pressure, and you can feel like them sucking the air into their lungs after they've survived this ordeal.
Yeah, it's really well done. Like I said, it's every time I go back and reread this comic, that's the thing that, like, oh man, I remember being 10 years old and like that really having a big impact on me. So then after that, they escape and they head into this room via this iris that opens up. And I don't know about you, Matt, but that reminded me, this whole sequence reminds me a lot of Luke in Bespin, where he's walking through the tunnels and like the irises are opening and he's wandering through. It has that same sort of feel to it. And that's where they find the Shanna robot. And we see that she's mostly just circuitry. And then the sentry mother has applied a skin-like face and a bit of her chest, but like the breasts are cut off. Like they're going to like add the, they're going to add the fake breasts later, which is kind of a weird bit. And then they said the sentry attacks Kate, and then Dirk shows up and actually blows the robot up at that point, and explains that how much that kind of hurt him, because that is, he refers to the robot as mother. Again, it's shades of Alien. And that's when again they get the second tape and they learn all about it. Dirk narrates this, and I like the detail that this is before the reveal that we find out that Dirk is a robot. But when he is talking in the flashback, his word balloons are robot-like. Like they become, all of a sudden the balloons are square and they're colored yellow, as if he's almost sort of reciting it in a kind of robot-y way, which I thought was a nice touch.
Yeah, like a mechanical voice.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. And then we see him getting built. And then there's that really grotesque reveal where he's like, am I a double? Only one way to find out. And he literally rips skin off of his forearm. And underneath the forearm, we see the, you know, servos and the gears. Again, like Empire Strikes Back, where we see Luke's hand after he got his hand cut off, and 2-1-B gives him that new one. And we see all like the gears and the servos working back and forth. And again, it was a very, I remember reading that panel just being at 10 years old, like, ugh, that's kind of gross. Like, oh my God, he just ripped his skin off. And then we have another series of panels, again, brilliantly put across by Brent Anderson, where there's a lot of dialogue between Dirk and Kazar and Shanna. And they set up earlier that Kazar is a little jealous of Dirk because him and Dirk and Shanna had a relationship. And obviously Kazar feels something for Shanna. How could you not feel something for Shanna, the She-Devil? And there's no action here other than just people talking. And so instead of these horizontal, these vertical panels, Brent Anderson reverses and gives us five vertical. I keep inverting the phrases. Gives us five horizontal panels where we just have the characters talking as Dirk finally, you know, Kazar figures out, oh, this place was supposed to be some sort of weird rich person's Disneyland, this whole Pangaea Savage Land thing. And that's where Dirk wanders off. And we get the final splash page. Well, not a splash page, the reverse of a splash page, where we see Pangaea the snowy waste of Pangaea giving way to the sort of lush green kind of thing. It's like a whole Genesis planet thing going on. And that is the end of the story. But as we said, it's next towards Shadowed Places. And it's very, despite the fact that Kazar is not a Tarzan character, it's got a real Tarzan-y feel of like, oh, okay, Tarzan is, or almost Conan, where he's going on this adventure. Now he's going to head on to this new part of the Savage Land where he's going to obviously encounter lots of new dinosaurs or kinds of crazy things that were going on. But it's, as I said, it's great that this issue is a complete thought. For your 50 cents, you get a complete story, but it is part of a larger whole. And again, I'm so disappointed in myself that I didn't go back and buy more Kazars, because again, I love this comic. I think it's just terrific.
It's a great book because, like I said, if you've read the previous issues, there's a lot of setup. In issue one, he first discovers Pangaea while looking for Zabu, and Shanna first encounters Dirk in issue six, and a lot of the previous issues is jealousy between both Kazar and Shannon, as it seems as though they're constantly meeting attractive women or attractive men, that suddenly they're like, gee, maybe I'm only with Kazar because he's the only other human male within millions of miles, although they do end up together. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I this has always been one of my favorite Mountain Comics, and it's as I said, it's like almost like the quintessential one, because it was something I would have never seen in any other place. And because of my newsstand, I was so voraciously reading, I gave it a shot, and boy, was I satisfied. And I've probably read this comic dozens of times at this point. So one last thing I want to mention is the letters page. There is a letters page called Through the Grapevine. The editor is Louise Jones. And there's a couple of fun things here. One, there's a drawing. There's a drawn letter from a Richard Howell, which I have to assume is the same Richard Howell who later on became a comics professional. And it says that it says, Dear Savage Land editors, more Zabu. And he just drew this fun little cute drawing of Zabu sitting there with a smile on his face. And then again, that popped out at me of like, oh, cool. They put a little drawing on the letters page. And again, I assume it's the Richard Howell because this thing looks professionally drawn. And so I just figure it's the guy who later went on to work at DC and Marvel and do stuff like that. And then the other thing that I noticed, which there's a letter from a Daniel Lee, who really dumps on Kazar. He says it is probably the stupidest comic I've ever read. Issues 1 through 3 were terrible, which is funny. He hates this comic. He read 3 issues. I love this comic. I read 1. It doesn't make any sense at all. He says Carlos Garzon is a terrible inker, and he ends it with, well, that's all I wanted to say. Of course, this letter won't be in print, because then again, as I said, you usually only print favorable letters. And the response is simply, usually, Daniel, but not always. And there's this, it's kind of just sad. Like, you feel like Louise Jones or Danny Fingeroff, whoever put together the letters page, was just kind of like, it was almost like, I'm not mad, I'm disappointed, Daniel. Like, there's just this kind of sadness to it. And you think, it is kind of mean to, like, write a letter to people who are obviously trying really hard to make a good comic book, and you just dump on it. So, you know what? If Kazar is stupid, just stop buying it. Like, you don't buy it anymore. Like, why do you keep it? You know, I never understand that. But as a kid, again, it was memorable to me to read that letter, because I think it made me think about, like, well, yeah, these are people that try to do this, you know, like they're just people doing their jobs. And I think I only wrote a handful of letters into comics. I never got anything printed. I wasn't like a Russell Burbage, but I think I always tried to be positive, because it's like, if you don't like a comic, just don't read it. You know, nobody's forcing you to buy it. So this comic was very, very influential to me.
Yeah, I don't understand. You know, like back then, that's how you had to vent. You couldn't just run on Facebook or Twitter and shout out something real mean real quick and then disappear. But yeah, like, yeah, you're right. I hated all 3 issues. Why didn't you stop after 1? Maybe you wanted to give it another go with 2.
But after you didn't 2, like, right.
This isn't for me, and I'm done. And, you know, that actually speaks more than writing a letter and then challenging them to print it by saying, oh, you probably won't print this.
Yeah, like kind of like his passive-aggressive kind of thing. So, but yeah, overall, I said I love this comic. And now, as over the course of the half an hour we've been talking, I think I am going to go to eBay and buy Kazar's 9, 10, 11 and just, like, report back and see if they hold up, because I like Bruce Jones as a writer. I love Brent Anderson, and I know this is a fun comic. I just really enjoyed it, and I was, as I said, I was so glad that you picked it, because I've been wanting to do it for four seasons. Nobody, I would send people a list, and no one ever picks Kazar, and I don't want to nudge people, so I'm glad that you picked it, and I'm really happy that we could wrap up Mountain Comics this season talking about one of my favorites. So thank you for doing this with me.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you so much for having me. Go to issue 12. Issue 12 is the final issue of that story arc.
Oh, good. All right. Good. Good to know. I will do that. Maybe I will get those issues, and I'll have to do like a Find Your Joy episode of FW Presents on these couple issues just to report back or something. Or maybe you can do it with me, man.
I would love to.
All right. Very cool. So, well, that's going to do it for this episode of Mountain Comics, this season of Mountain Comics. Matt, I really appreciate you joining me and doing this, your very first podcast. I hope you enjoyed it.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you very much. So thanks, everybody, for listening. As I normally do for the season finale episodes of Mountain Comics, I'm going to run some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback for the entire previous season of Mountain Comics. Stay tuned. But in the meantime, Ben and I are going to crack open some Yoo-Hoos and watch the sun come down on the porch over Lake Wall and Paul Pack. And as I said, stay tuned. We'll be back with some listener feedback.
Greetings, internerds. It is I, Mephisto. For the past two Halloweens, a callow cadre of casters has confounded my plans. First, they survived my Mephisto versus miniseries. Then they navigated the perambulations of Dream Country. But this time, they stand no chance. I've trapped them within my hotel, the Inferno. And if Las Vegas isn't torture enough, the only entertainment they have is a variety of horror comics. Their only chance to escape is to find joy and positivity in these tales of terror.
Mephisto, why are you still doing this?
What do you mean?
You know the gang keeps this crossover going because it's fun, and they like podcasting together. They do it even without your shenanigans.
No, that cannot be. My will is all. You are but playthings in my merciless machinations.
Yeah, sure, but can you go to the living room and watch some streaming while I finish the promo?
Impudent geek!
Mephisto vs. the Podcasters 3, a crossover podcast event featuring the Married with Comics podcast, Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos podcast, the Secret Wars and Beyond podcast, and Jeff and Rick present Unpacking the Power of Power Pack. Find it where all fine podcasts are casting.
Why is Mandalorian Season 2 not out yet? Curse that House of Mouse!
He's been here since the stay-at-home order started. I really don't think that applied to immortal entities, but he's all, never can be too careful. And if he finishes my Cheetos one more time...
And action! It's Fade Out. Hosted by film fanatic Rob Kelly and a roster of special guests, Fade Out will examine the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. And we're back with listener feedback. As promised, as I normally do at the end of every season of Mountain Comics, I go through the feedback for all the episodes of the previous season, and including the final episode of the previous season, because, of course, we don't do feedback for that episode. So we're going to start off with episode 25, which was at the end of season 3 of Mountain Comics, and that was where I covered Iraq, Son of Thunder number 3, with the writer, the legendary Roy Thomas. That was exciting. We got comments from Joe Cabrera, Net Administrator, David S. Gutierrez, Edo Bosnar, Michael Dinas, Gotham's Mansion, Martin Gray, Ward Hill Terry, Sphinx Magoo, Matt Sarice, Captain Entropy, Boston Moss, and David Galler, who says, what a fantastic episode. Listen to Thomas talk about his love of Howard's work is really lovely. Agreed, David. Chris Franklin, my pal and from this network, he says, a great episode, Rob, and what a guest to have on your season finale. It's always a pleasure to read Roy's thoughts on his comic projects or to hear them in person as we did at Heroes Con a few years back. I don't recall seeing Iraq much as a kid, but I was pretty much a superheroes-only type of kid at the time, so I probably would have passed it up because I was dumb. It's a shame that the Valda miniseries never saw the light of day, and even worse, if McFarlane never got paid for it. No wonder the guy went creator-owned only. I had Hercules and Machiste from the Remco Warlord series of figures. I wanted Travis Morgan himself, but all I could ever find was Hercules and Machiste. It would have been cool to have Iraq interact with He-Man, who back then was also part of the DCU, of course. It's also great to see Roy recently coming back to some of the properties he helped make great, like the Captain America and the Invaders one-shot, and the new Conan story he did with Alan Davis. Maybe DC will wake up and give us more Thomas-penned Iraq. That would be great, Chris. And I gotta tell you, I didn't know that Roy did a new Conan story with Alan Davis. What? I gotta find that. Holy jeez. Again, thanks for the comment. And then we had one other comment from someone named Enigma, who says, why couldn't Ryan Daly have been invited on to discuss his love for Roy's writing style and their ill-fated meeting, or have Shag asked him about what influenced Roy to develop the Earth to Aquaman into the hero we all know and love? By your name, Enigma, I guess I'm not supposed to know who you are, but that's a very inside comment, so I have to wonder if that isn't somebody from inside the network. I don't know. We'll have to figure that out. Well, I have the winner in the spring to figure it out. So, again, thank you for the comments for that episode. Yes, it was obviously an amazing honor and thrill to talk to Roy Thomas and to have him on Mountain Comics. It was just so exciting. So now moving on to other episodes from this season, which is the first episode of the season, which is episode 26, where I covered Captain America number 275 with Sean Ross. We have comments from Chris Franklin, Martin Gray, Ryan Daly, Ido Bosnar, John Schaefer-Hames, Mike Dynas, Brian Rosen, Matt Ev, Martin Gray, Brian Linton, David S. Gutierrez, Captain Entropy, Damian Whiter, Ward Hill Terry, and Matt Saroyce, who says, so happy to have a new season of Mountain Comics. I refer to my Mountain Comics as Comfort Comics, as they are from this era as well. I fall right between you and Sean Ross in age of having been 9 when this comic came out. It holds so much meaning. Captain America has been a role model and an icon to me for almost as long as I can remember. Be the best human you can possibly be, even when it's hard. Even when everyone else seems to be doing everything wrong, do what is right. I certainly didn't get it back then. Much like Cap, I thought the Nazi threat had been ended in the 40s. I should point out, I'm a white dude who grew up in northern Massachusetts. For years, no, decades, I knew there were still racists out there, but I thought there was a small sect of comic book-like villains lurking in the shadows. The light of society shunned them. As we know, I couldn't have been more wrong. 2 days ago, I participated in a Black Lives Matter march, something I never thought I would do or even be necessary just a decade ago. That's when I started dating a black woman. After our first date, she asked me if the race thing was an issue. I thought it was a ridiculous question. After we were married and we traveled together on vacation outside of Massachusetts, I saw firsthand the experience black people suffer in this country. In all my years of being a passenger in a car, and I've traveled with some very aggressive drivers, we were pulled over on a weekly basis when she drove. I can also tell you the officer's attitude would change when they looked past her and saw a white guy sitting in the passenger seat. Much less aggressive, much more polite. She never received a ticket. We were always pulled over because our car either matched a description or one time we didn't have the proper amount of bolts holding the license plate on the car. On one memorable trip, too, we went to a restaurant with her kids from a previous marriage, and the hostess tried to seat us separately. Even after settling the issue, she asked if we would like separate checks. I could tell by the look in my wife's eyes she didn't want a scene to be made in front of the girls, so once again, she took the indignity in silence. It took all these things to wake me up. Of course, things have gotten even worse in the last 4 years. All through dating, I wore Captain America t-shirts, read comics, and bought Cap merch. My wife thought it odd, but she smiled and nodded because she knew I enjoyed it. When the Marvel movie started coming out, I dragged her along. I think she's a bigger MCU fan than I am. Anyway, and I apologize for going on so long, and now I bring it back to Captain America in this issue. While she and I are no longer married, we are still the best of friends. And because of Chris Evans' incredible portrayal of Cap, she gets not only why I was such a fan of the character, Captain America may be a fictional character, but he's one of the best possible role models for everyone out there. I honestly feel me trying to be much like Cap is the reason she fell in love with me. And this issue is one of the biggest lessons taught me. Wow, Matt, that was an amazing email. Of course, I just had Matt on the show. I didn't want to embarrass him and ask him about it on the air. Because I just thought this letter was so heartfelt, and I really appreciated the comment that he left, and I just wanted to read it on the air as is. There's just so much to unpack there and so much to learn from. I really appreciate him sharing that with us. And sadly, yes, there is so much more work to be done. Of course, as I'm recording this, We have had a presidential election, and naturally it has turned out in some ways the way I hoped it would, and maybe we are making some progress back in the other direction. But man, Matt, thank you so much for that letter. That was just really quite an amazing thing to read, and I said I wanted to make sure that I read it here on the air. So moving on to the comments for episode 27, which was New Teen Titans number 25 with Tom Pamenarice. Comments from Matt Royce again, David H. Gutierrez, Chris Franklin, Martin Gray, Dr. Ange, Jonathan, Bradley Null, Ward Hill Terry, and Captain Entropy, who says, thanks for the discussion, guys. I missed this particular issue, but I always thought the New Teen Titans had a realistically mixed attitudes towards space. I mean, Surefire is obviously comfortable there, and Raven is comfortable with weird. Robin is exceptionally bright and capable of adapting to new situations, but it sounds like that's really being put to the test here, as he's totally a fish out of water or a bird out of air. The others are all varying degrees of, this is uncomfortably weird and scary. What's interesting to me is how the character of Dick Grayson developed over the years. Nightwing has a great team up with Superman in Action 841 and 842, wherein they and many other heroes and villains are kidnapped by aliens. Despite the large ensemble, it really becomes the Superman and Nightwing show because they trust one another and have experience in the environment. It even becomes useful that Dick can read some Tamaranian. Given his experiences in Teen Titans, it seems completely natural. Finally, like Rob, I also appreciate that this comic made clear that the Titans were intervening in an actual war. They weren't going to be able to tie anybody up and hand them over to the authorities, and Coriander's comments with her conflict with her sister had implications far bigger than family therapy could resolve. Yeah, Captain Entropy, that is one of the things I liked about New Teen Titans, is that they Marv Wolfman did bring in that additional context of what happens when you maybe interfere in wars that necessarily don't really involve you exactly. So yeah, I always thought that was great. So again, thank you for the comment. Moving on to episode 28, Marvel Superheroes number 67, with my fellow Poconos vacation haver, Keith Bowman. Comments from Matt Royce, Chris Franklin, Rob L. McCarthy, Captain Entropy, Steve Cronin, Ado Bosnar, Ward Hull Terry, Martin Gray, Dallin Baumgarten, and Damian Druitt Whiter, who says, in fairness to the Marvin subscription department, Shogun Warriors and Moon Knight were both written by Doug Manick, so they're not that different. Siskoid from our network says, coincidentally, there was an issue of Marvel Superheroes in my own summer comics, Texas Comics, I guess. It's the one with the Hulk fighting Rhino, number 105. It came in a double pack at the small Walmart in town with Uncanny X-Men number 153, which I did find your joy about. The X-Men issue had led me to collecting X-Men, but I never saw another issue of MSH on the stands because number 105 was, in fact, the last issue. Yeah, I think I kind of remember that. I think I bought every issue of Marvel Superheroes, and I don't, if I recall right, they didn't even say in that issue that it was canceled. Like, they didn't mention it. They just, book just stopped appearing. You had to, when we were kids, they had to have thicker skins back then. You didn't find out final issue or anything. The book just stopped. Moving on to episode 29, which is Defenders number 101 with Martin Gray. We got comments from Ryan Daly, Matt Royce, Damon Druitt Whiter, Captain Entropy, Martin Gray, Siskoid, Dr. Ange, Chris Franklin, and Jack Bone, who says, the Defenders. I read a good run my friend had. By good run, I mean what seemed like three or four out of every six issues. Read like that, the team lineup changed like dreams, and it was probably easier to follow the subplots than the plots. I didn't read 101, but when I saw Sunshine in the scans, I remember there's an issue where he shows up again. It's a Devil Slayer solo issue, because where else are you going to get that? It was pretty bad for him, but it ends in hope. What I mainly remember from that issue is that the 10-year-old who's owned it before, maybe a younger sibling, had industriously colored in every O in the lettering. Wow, that's a weird OCD kind of thing. Yes, Sunshine does appear again. Back when I mentioned this issue over on our Twitter feed, J.M. DeMatteis, the writer himself, popped in to mention that yes, Sunshine does appear again. So that was awesome. I love it that and JMD listened to the episode again, which is just so exciting because I'm just such a big fan of this. Matt Ebb says, yay, Mountain Comics, another fantastic episode. Always nice to hear Martin's dulcet northern tones. Oddly, I went on holiday to a caravan park near Filey a few times too. Wonder if it was the same one. It didn't have any comics when I went, alas. My own holiday comics were limited to a couple issues of Mighty World of Marvel picked up on the Norfolk Broads. Defenders is one of those series I keep thinking I should explore more. As an X-Men devotee, I absolutely devoured New Defenders, but have a barely dipped a toe in the pre-125 issues. I'm a big fan of J.M. DeMatteis, Namor and Hellstrom too. Seriously, the Essential Marvel Horror Collection featuring Son of Satan is superb, so this seems like a horrible, gaping chasm in my Marvel knowledge. That said, I did read the Giffen DeMatteis McGuire version of Defenders, the 5-issue mini from 2005, and is highly recommended for anyone who thinks the non-team could do with a bit more blah-ha-ha, and for those like myself who are rigid in their insistence that Namor should not have nipples. That's a good hill to die on, Matt. And then finally, the comments for episode 30, Star Wars Annual number 2, or my guest was Tim Price. We got comments from Matt Sorois, Chris Franklin, Brian Linton, Captain Entropy, Tim Price himself, and Laurel, who says, although I'm saddened to hear Tim's mother didn't get a say in having her comics declared trash, the burning thing was not too necessarily vindictive. My grandparents lived in the mountains of North Carolina, and my granddaddy used to burn trash too. It's rural. Road was paved around 1972, so not having to lug material to the dump was a normal part of their lives. I remember the practice stopped when I was young, and more items were unsafe to burn, like styrofoam egg cartons, etc. Thank you for the info, Laurel. And Dr. Ange says, I didn't read too many Star Wars comics, but hearing there was this period where Han was off limits made me think of two ideas that could have been used, or that maybe I should write. One, a Maltese Falcon pastiche where bounty hunters and crooks are all trying to obtain the frozen Han Solo, only to have the person in carbonite, they finally get to be someone else or a fake. Two, a world where the person unfrozen in Return of the Jedi and killed in Force Awakens is a Han Solo clone. The real Han is still frozen somewhere. He gets thawed out after the events of Episode 9, still young because of the suspended animation, and lives an adventurer's life. I love that one. That's a great idea, Ed. I think Rudy Nebra's inks are a big influence on the pencils. The desiccated face panel certainly seems more like lines than Infantino would have typically put. Great episode. Thank you, Ange. Yeah, those are both great ideas. And again, thank you for listening. So that's going to do it for the feedback for Season 4 of Mountain Comics. I really appreciate everybody that left comments, either on our website or on Twitter, which is at FWPMountainCom. I think I say this at the end of every season. When I started the show, I really figured it would have an incredibly limited audience, and it kind of does. I'm not really tracking the downloads of Mountain Comics, but this is obviously not one of the more popular shows on the network. It does have kind of a very devoted following. If you just go through the names of that I read for each episode, it's kind of the same people over and over again, which is great. I really enjoy that, and I really enjoy how much people. Like Mountain Comics, again, it seems like such a specific show, but of course, so many people out there have had Vacation Comics, so they can relate, and it's really fun to do this show. So I'm kind of sad that we're wrapping up, but I do, I think I say this every year too, it just feels weird to do it in the winter, to talk about Poconos in the winter, so this is a show that's going to go on a hiatus for a while. I'll be back probably in May or June for Season 5 of Mountain Comics. There's still a whole bunch of comics left to cover. So until I get through all those, we're going to just keep doing Mountain Comics. So that is going to do it. Thanks everybody for listening. Thanks for all my guests. Thanks for everybody who retweets the show. I really do appreciate it. You can find back episodes of FW Presents on our website, firewaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Amazon Music. And if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you're going to unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name-checked on a show of your choice. Once again, big thanks to Matt Sorois for coming by and talking Kazar with me. So exciting. What other chance am I going to have to talk about Kazar, for Pete's sake? So that's going to do it for this episode of Mountain Comics. I am going to go through my old photo albums and look at some old photos of my time in the Poconos just to recall those fun August days when things were warmer and sunnier, because now as I'm recording this, it's dark and cold. I don't like it. So anyway, Mountain Comics will be back for Season 5. Thanks everybody for listening, and we will see you later. Bye-bye.